Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
And those are the wines that I find to be more pleasing, better. It does not surprise me that lower-priced wines are winning the competitions. And they're not winning because they have better, well, they're winning because they're better made. They're not killed with the alcohol and too high grapes and raisins. They're making the very expensive wines, to a big extent, are made with a fairly high content of raisins, and that's not a good winemaking practice. And I think it's too bad that a lot of people... Let me just change the subject for a minute. In 2008 at the State Fair, California State Fair, the 2005 Charles Shaw Chardonnay, Two Buck Chuck. Charles Shaw Chardonnay called Two Buck Chuck because it sells for $2 a bottle. The 2005 Chardonnay of Charles Shaw won Best Chardonnay of California at the State Fair. The State Fair was so embarrassed about it. I'm on the board there, is how I know this. What do we do about this? I say, you beat the drums and tell the world about it. It's what you do. Why should a wine be beaten down because the company that makes it only charges $2 a bottle for it. Now it's $3, I think. If they are smart enough to make wine that's really nice and that's better than all the others, we ought to give them credit for it. You shouldn't have to brag. He shouldn't have to be embarrassed about it. He was embarrassed for the State Fair that he said, well, we can't announce that the best Chardonnay in the state of California only costs $2.
I said,
why not?
And you should.
You can if it's true. You can. And I said, let me taste all the finalists of the high wines. And okay, we did that. We laid them out here. This one over here, probably, I don't know the analysis because I'm just looking at the glass of wine.
Yeah.
I can see that that's got to be close to 16 alcohol. You can't, that can't be a good wine. This one here has too much Surly. It's so they've left it on the yeast lees in the barrel so long that it's just very, it's so buttery it doesn't taste like Chardonnay anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This one here, it's got too much oak. My God, the oak flavor covers the Chardonnay character. I don't get any Appley Chardonnay at all. I get only oak. And right down the list, I say, I see why the judges didn't like that one. I see why they didn't like that one. I see why they didn't like that one. Right down the line, I see why Charles Shaw won. It's balanced, the acidity is good, the tannin was perfect, the flavor, not the best Chardonnay flavor in the world, not the most Chardonnay flavor, but nice and clean. Nice, clean wine, very, very enjoyable. And I did something after this that, because it stuck in my mind so much. I got over the next week or two, winemakers that I know and winery owners that I know that aren't going to be named, they would say, Dick, what the devil is going on at the State Fair? And I say, what do you mean? You allow someone like the Charles Shaw producer to make a special wine that would win the judging? And I said, well, you're a winemaker. You know that you can't make a special wine that you know is going to win. You can't do it. I can't do it. Why do you say that? Well, that's what they've done. They've taken a special wine and they've to win, or else the judges are bad. And I said, no, the judges are very competent. You know the judges aren't bad. And so this happened three or four times to people. And so I said, I'm going to go down and buy a case of Two Buck Chuck. It's going to cost me $25 for a case. That's what it costs. And I did it at the Charles Shaw in Napa. And I bought a case of the 2005 Charles Shaw Chardonnay. And I gave each one of these guys, I went around and I gave them a bottle of it. And I said, okay, we're friends. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to taste this wine, swallow it, and tell me that's not a bad bottle of Chardonnay. It's okay. Don't have to tell me it's the greatest Chardonnay ever. I'm not trying to claim that. I don't claim it's the greatest Chardonnay, but it's the best Chardonnay of California right now. And I want you to tell me that. Not one of them ever got back to me. 12 bottles, they never got back to me. So what I'm saying is there's a bias that's built in favor of high price. They assume that high price is better. It isn't necessarily. It could be, but not very often. Middle price wins very often, and occasionally a real low price one wins. But you see that in judgings, and I see it, more and more in judgings. And if in your blog, if you can make that point sometimes that if they're ashamed to pour a low price wine that they like, then by all means open the wine, pour it into a decanter, and don't put the bottle, put the decanter on the table, and don't tell them what it is, and say, wait, the wine I've chosen for you tonight, it's a Pinot Noir, it's a Cabernet, it's whatever it is, Zinfandel. I hope you like it. We thought that it would go well with this food. And the people are going to ooh and ah, because they don't know what it is. If they saw the label, they would already have some bias. They'd either say, well, I don't like Almaden, I don't like Palmasan, I don't like Charles Krug, I do, or I do like, you know, Mondavi or whatever. Mondavi preached quality, but the wines weren't always that good. Charles Krug had better wines many times when I tasted, but the Mondavi would be quite a bit more expensive. Martini, the same thing. Louis Martini, for years, had great wines at relatively lower prices in Napa Valley, and I always gave him credit for that because he didn't get hung up over the image thing. And in a blog, if you could just point that out to people that don't go by price, don't go by the looks of the label even. Just put it in a decanter. Have somebody else put the wine in a decanter and don't tell you what it is, and just enjoy it with your meal, or don't enjoy it. As you know, be critical. If you don't like it, say so. Say why you don't and so on. And you'll enjoy winemaking. You'll enjoy wine with dinner a whole lot more than you have been enjoying it. I got a feeling people don't enjoy wine when they look at the label and want to know what the price is. And I had one guy one time, it was a lady actually, my wife wanted to kick her. We're at a dinner, and this lady walked over with a glass of wine, and a bottle, she brought the wine. Said, Dick, tell me if I like this wine or not. And I said, I could taste it and tell you whether I like it, but I can't tell you whether you like it. You like it as you're going to taste. But she was, my wife said, stupid. She said, here, tell me if I should like this wine. I'm not going to tell her if she should like wine. You're supposed to taste the wine yourself without seeing the label, and then you decide whether you... But you'll be doing them a big favor if you make that point in your blog, I would think.
I am so grateful for what you just shared, because I think it means so much more coming from you. I've been saying similar things for years, for as long as I can remember, actually. Don't outsource that part. There's a reason justice is blind. Palate justice mm-hmm. should be blind as well. Mm-hmm. Palates don't lie. Tongues do. I've mm-hmm. said it all because I believe in it so deeply. And I think the only honest way to find, you know, a passage to yourself, the yes. wine way,
yes. mm-hmm.
is to do exactly what you described. Invite a bunch of people, buy wines from $2 to $200, whatever you want. It mm-hmm. doesn't really matter what they are. The varietals don't matter. Vintages matter in some cases, but, you know, let's just not even get into the weeds. It really is completely, as much as you can, I shouldn't say completely, I think we're all biased humans. We just can't completely divorce ourselves, but as much as you can, take the bias out of it. You'd be so surprised how much you learn about yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Just be honest.
Well, there are others, don't give me all the credit here, that Narcy David feels like I do, Dan Berger feels like I do, Daryl Cordy in Sacramento feels the same way. There's a lot of people are, I'm embarrassed for California that we've got so many high-priced and undrinkable wines. Napa and Sonoma usually. It embarrasses me. Well, it embarrasses them too. They don't like it either. They would prefer to see wines. The classic wines of BV over the years that Andrei Chelyshev always made, almost, I think I can say never, never were over 14 alcohol. They were 12 and a half most of the time, 13. All the great growths of Bordeaux, 12 and a half, 13 alcohol. The great Burgundies, Latache, all of them. Under 13 alcohol, mostly. If they're over 13, it's 13.1, 13.2, never above 14 alcohol. So historically in the world, what I'm saying is true. The best wines are under 14 alcohol.
Do you feel that in California we in fact have a competitive advantage because we ripen fruit so well because of the weather, you know, climactic conditions largely, unlike in Europe, which is not nearly as blessed geographically? I mean, we really have no reason not to make good wines is what I feel. How do you feel about that?
I think that America suffers by being populated by Americans. Americans always seem to want to judge quality by weight. You judge quality by high price, you judge it by being big, by being too much alcohol, that's how they judge it. And I hope that Winston Churchill is correct. His expression that he said that I like the most is, leave it to the Americans to always do the right thing after exhausting all other possibilities. And I hope that this is America right now is chasing alcohol and wine. I hope that that's one possibility they tried. I hope they'll come back and finally do the right thing and get back to under 14. That's what I hope.
I think it's a very precarious time for this particular industry because it's grown so big so fast and there's so much at stake.
Yeah.
And so many political and marketing forces.
The ground there and a lot of...
Yeah, that I think, and unfortunately it doesn't benefit the consumer in the end, mm-hmm. because it's controlled by people who do not have their best interests at heart. Would you agree?
Well, I do hope that they'll get over this high alcohol. I hope that they'll suddenly, one day, each person, I hope will, it all happens at different days maybe, but I hope that each person one day says, oh my gosh, I don't like those 15 alcohol wines. They're a lot easier to drink at 13. I can buy them for half the price from these bigger companies. Maybe I'll start doing that. And if I'm embarrassed to be seen with a wine that everybody knows is only $8 a bottle, if that embarrasses me, I'll start serving my wine in decanters. I hope they do that.
Well, judging with you was such an eye-opening experience. The level of respect and consideration you gave each glass of wine of your peers was nothing short of inspirational because, you know, with your depth and breadth of experience, I mean, you could be and do whatever you want. But you choose deliberately to really pay very close attention to what's in front of you. And, you know, other people are not privileged to be in the position that I was, which is to observe firsthand who you are, but I can tell you that you live your rhetoric, you live your words,
yeah,
you
do.
Live your mind.
Well, I don't have that good a memory that I can afford to start making up stories. I won't remember what I said last time.
Too funny. And speaking of stories, there's so much more that I want to ask you. I have literally a million questions that has to do with your, you know, work background. I mean, the chapter on Andre alone, the fact that you worked with him shoulder to shoulder and what you learned from him, you know, you touched upon his quite obsessive, and I meant that in the best sense of the word, quest for cleanliness. I have so much appreciation for that because it's such a basic thing, but it makes fundamental differences. It's just one of the things that he taught you. And from what I understand, he was really such a gracious, graceful, understated, generous human being.
Well, thank you. That's all I can say.
It's such a, everything that you've experienced in your world, I think, should be propagated. It should be bottled. I don't know in what format it should come, but, you know, just being around people like Andre and how he was holding himself accountable for what he did.
Many people have asked me if Andre deserves the credit that he gets. A lot of credit. Does he deserve it? And I said in the book, I believe.
Yeah,
he deserves it in spades. He really deserves it because he not only made great wine at a time when almost nobody else did.
Yeah.
But he did it with baling wire and duct tape.
Yeah.
Because the owner of the winery, George de Latour's daughter, believed that she was royalty. She really thought she was royalty. And she said, that winery owes me to give me all the money I need to keep up my lifestyle. I don't owe that winery anything. And she thought that you could buy a new car and the car would stay new and you didn't have to add oil or you didn't have to have a grease job every so often or you don't have to maintain the thing. She didn't want to maintain the winery. She wanted, that winery has the obligation to give me money. I don't have any obligation to put any money in that winery. And of course, she lost it because of that. She had to sell it because she failed to put in. But Andre did yeoman's work in keeping the vineyards going well and the winery going well, and I did too while I worked for her. But you don't get a free shot every time in life. You have to take the bitter with the sweet. And Andre took the bitter with the sweet. The bitter was he had to work for her, but he still did it best. So yeah, I learned that from him. I learned it from my dad too.
Well, I think we all need to hear those lessons and take heart in the fact that this value was built on very different premises than most people these days prophesize about. There was a lot of real blood, sweat, and tears mm-hmm. that you witnessed and lived and worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much want to continue this conversation. We'll stop momentarily, but I'm officially requesting another episode when we're going to delve into the history of the Valley as it intertwines with your personal history. And of course, I want to talk about your family. One little teaser I'll put out there is that I've always regarded Heidi Peterson Barrett as a winemaker of record for Screaming Eagle. I've learned as a result of reading your book that even though that is in fact accurate, but even though you weren't a winemaker of record, the very first vintage of Screaming Eagle, you helped craft. I don't think obviously those that read your book would know that, but I don't think that fact has ever been propagated, and I found it stunning because I followed this winery for many years, and I think it's such an enigma for most, mm-hmm. and I want to get into that and flesh it out. I'm dying to hear all the details and your relationship with Gustave Dalval. And
he was this prince. He was Andre type.
Wow.
Of course, he's Italian, something about people who grow up in America, they're different. I like people who come from another country. They have a different point of view, and I trust them. Gustave Della Valle was like that, as Andre mm-hmm. was. They both really wanted to excel. They didn't want any BS. They wanted to make sure that wine was right. And when Gustav hired Heidi, and then she walked in and said, "Oh my gosh, I can't fix this wine. It's all acidic." And Goose, I said, well, I hope that you know how to fix that. And she said, well, I'm going to ask my dad. And of course, I did show her how, because we had that kind of thing happen. There's always mistakes made in wineries. Mm-hmm. Big wineries have lots of mistakes. And so one of the things I learned was how to fix it. And if you have too much SO2, too much acidity, there's a way to fix it and 25 ways not to do it. And so we did that. Dimitri was very, he did the same thing. when we had too much, we learned, I don't know if I should go into that, but I can, I guess, that suppose you have too much acid in a wine, it's going to taste way, way, way too sour. It's going to exaggerate the hotness of the alcohol that's there. It'll exaggerate the astringency of the tannin that's there. And it just won't taste right. And nobody can drink it. Okay, how do you get rid of it? You put in something to neutralize the acid. Well, if you pour it into the tank, it's going to be, how do you neutralize acid? You put in caustic, okay, lye. You pour L-Y-E, lye. Sodium hydroxide, that's how you neutralize it. Well, you pour in a bunch of lye? No. The lye, or potassium carbonate, whatever you use, is going to be so strong, if you pour it in all around where it first contacts the wine, it's going to burn the wine. It'll severely ruin the wine, so that when you put the right amount in and mix the tank up, yeah, you've got rid of the acid, but the wine doesn't taste good anymore because it's been caustic burned. And so how you do it, and what I told Heidi, is you set a tank, set a pump down on the floor. You're pumping wine out of the bottom. You pump it over the top and right back into the same tank. So now you got a fast stream of wine going in here. You put your potassium hydroxide or potassium carbonate, safer, potassium carbonate, which is the same thing. It just doesn't hit it as hard. And you put it into a burette up here on top of the tank. And you put in a drop at a time in this fast stream of wine going back into the tank. Drip, drip, drip. It goes in, the drip is so small that it gets immediately neutralized. It never has a chance to burn the wine. And so it does that. Okay, and it's going to take you all day because you're going to drip, drip, drip. You calculate, you analyze the acid, find out how much is there. Now you can calculate, you know exactly how much potassium hydroxide or potassium carbonate you're going to need. You get that, you dissolve it in a bunch of water, and you stand up here at the top, and now you drip it in slowly. Okay, every hour, you take a sample out of the tank, and you line them up like this. And then you show them to Gustav Della Valle. Say, here's how I'm doing it. My dad showed me how, and I know how to do it. I can handle it. And she did it. She did it like this. And Gustav, she says, I want to tell you what he said. She says, he's over here and he tastes this wine and he tastes this one and tastes this one. He says, acid's going down, price is going up. And she laughed and I laughed. And that's
what Gustav, a great, you know, story. What a great story. I'm going to call it an intermission.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.